and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who met his wife while training for the 400 meters in Seattle and is eating gluten-free while lusting after bread, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston. Welcome to the latest cast on my Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, today we're going to be talking about three of my favorite subjects: money, women, and power, although not necessarily in that order. And as I've gotten deeper and deeper into the medical community, I found a number of blogs and bloggers who are docs, and they have some really interesting, really unique perspectives. And they also happen to write in an incredibly entertaining but educational style. And if you haven't checked out callmedoctor.us, you definitely should today. Well, I have the distinct pleasure of hosting our guest today, Dr. Ramsey Tate, MD, FAAP. She is a board-certified pediatrician. She is wrapping up fellowship in pediatric emergency medicine. She is also active in women in medicine professional groups and committed to helping other women build successful, rewarding careers in academic medicine. Well, how'd she get started? Frustrated by the lack of financial literacy among physicians and alarming rates of burnout in her colleagues, she started this blog, the Call Me Doctor blog at callmedoctor.us, to share finance, career, and productivity tips for young academic physicians. Dr. Tate believes that better balance is possible for every physician. Well, welcome, Dr. Tate.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Dave, and for the warm welcome.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Well, tell us a bit about yourself. What led you here to this point? What's inspired you to be a doctor?
Oh, my gosh. We could talk a whole podcast just about how people end up pursuing a career in medicine. For myself, I was a non-traditional applicant. I had worked in health services research for a few years before I even entertained the notion of going to medical school. Mm. I had the opportunity to work with some physicians who were also researchers, working on issues that were important to me, issues around disparities in healthcare and social justice work. And that's really what led me to a career in medicine. I wanted to be like them. Mm. And that's how also I pursued a career in pediatrics, because I felt like that was where I had the best natural role as an advocate for children in this country and could do the best work over the course of a long career.
Were you doing research specifically in pediatrics?
I was not. Mm. Yeah, I was actually doing research in lung cancer screening and in racial healthcare disparities.
So you got a lot of exposure to a lot of different areas. What's this journey been like for you? You know, you think about going to medical school. You went after working in the field for a little bit, or what was that like?
That's correct. Yeah, I went back to medical school after working for a few years. I had actually trained in undergraduate to be a diplomat. I had no experience in medicine. You know, I wasn't someone who had ever set foot in a lab, and I can proudly say I still haven't. I didn't have any background in science. For me, it was about social justice and interacting with people one-on-one. And so it was a long slog for me to get through my medical education and training. It included going back to undergraduate education for a year to do a post-bac program, just to take things like organic chemistry and biology and apply to medical school. So I think that my perspective has always been a little bit different from many physicians who kind of set out along that path in high school. I had more experience of the world. I had traveled internationally and worked in human rights work as well. And I've sort of been both an insider to the process of medical training and the acculturation that comes with it, and an outsider. And I've really tried hard to maintain that perspective to see what it does to us to train as young physicians, how it makes us better, and how it makes us weaker.
Well, you go through all this stuff, your whole journey here, and you get into residency, and now you're a fellowship, and you're an MD, and who also happens to blog. So tell us about that. What inspired you to start blogging?
Yeah, you know, and it's a relatively recent thing that I've started. I just started blogging last fall. And partly it was the challenge of it. It's something totally different than anything that I had done before. I do a lot of public speaking, and I really enjoy engaging with people when I can see them face to face. and have great conversations and learn from one another. But I had never tried blogging, a totally different way of interacting with people. So I thought I'd give it a shot. I started callmedoctor.us as a forum to share information that I've learned along my journey, as well as through a systematic study of young female physicians and what makes them successful on their own terms.
Well, and I think that's such a great topic, and I think I can hear in your writing is your incredible feel for these subjects. You are passionate about these things, and I'm sure many people are wondering, how the heck do you find time to do this through your fellowship? What do you enjoy about it that drives you to do it?
Great question. I think that finding time to do anything that we're passionate about during our medical training is a real struggle. And that's a topic that I kind of address on Call Me Doctor as well. I think that having passions and remembering who we are outside of medicine is part of how we can make ourselves burnout-proof. Mm-hmm. Burnout is absolutely epidemic among physicians. Whether you're young or old, whether you're training or have been out practicing for 20 years, burnout affects all of us. Just the other day, I was reading a newsletter from one of the state professional societies that I'm a member of, and there was another obituary for a physician in my specialty who committed suicide. And every time I see one of those, it really drives me to look at how I can share better information about making ourselves more resilient with other physicians. So to specifically answer your question about how I find time, there's a technique that I write about on the blog called MM90, or My Morning 90, and it's how I carve out some time and space to pursue goals that are important to me.
Mm. So it's finding that you time. It sounds like it's kind of a release for you. It helps you work out whatever you're going through. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I think it also is about career development, too. It helps me in a lot of different dimensions. So My Morning 90 is really my secret weapon for how I stay successful and how I feel balanced. It's a technique that I use to create that time and space. And what it actually looks like for me on a typical day is that I roll out of bed, I grab a cup of coffee before I check my phone or email. I think phone or email are the quickest roads to burnout for physicians and probably anybody. But before I check my phone or email, I sit down with a project that's important to me. I set a timer for 45 minutes, and regardless of whether I feel like doing it, whether I am motivated, whatever kind of mood I'm in, I commit to sitting there until that timer goes off. After it goes off, after 45 minutes, I let myself eat some breakfast. I still don't check my phone or email. And I sit down and I do it again.
You're strong.
So it's a total of 90 minutes. Yeah, I this is one of the things that when I set out to interview other academic physicians who had been successful on their own terms, and also looked at people from other fields and how they're successful, a constant theme that I saw running through it was building distraction-free zones and finding times to work that take motivation and behavioral cues out of the picture. So many different productivity sort of gurus or people who study behavioral science recommend finding time that you are away from your phone, from any sort of technological distraction, and creating a distraction-free zone to work on something that's important to you. And it may be blogging. Sometimes it's, I'm a researcher. Sometimes it's working on my research manuscripts. Sometimes it's doing exercise or yoga. It doesn't matter what it is. What matters is having that time, and preferably at the beginning of your day, so that no matter what happens the rest of the day, you feel like you've accomplished something that's important to you.
Well, and with kids and life that happens and husbands and wives and all these distractions, I mean, it's and some of these are great things, but having time for ourselves, I think, focus time on us can help keep us going.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't always even have to be just about ourselves. For other women physicians that I talk to, some of them try to use this time to do things like read with their kids. Mm. So it's less about how you use the time than that you carve out time and space to pursue something that is a goal, a personal goal for you, something that's not told to you a goal that's not set by your program director or by the faculty that you work with,
right,
but something
right.
that really keeps you whole and healthy.
Well, let me just kind of redirect the subject here real quick.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
One of the ways that you and I got in touch and how I stumbled across your blog was on the subject of student debt. And I really enjoyed your post that talked about IBR and PER and moonlighting, so I know this is a subject close to your heart. Tell us a bit about your experiences with student debt, with this journey that you've gone through of being in school, being out of school, and then back to medical school. What have you been through, and what have you seen some of your colleagues go through?
Yeah, you know, I think that financial planning is a vastly under-addressed topic in medical education. And certainly, as someone who had not planned a career in medicine before I embarked on one, mm-hmm. I really underappreciated the amount of stress and strain that medical education debt puts on young physicians, and also just how it's ballooning over time. When I talk to physicians who trained a decade ago, which really isn't that long ago in our professional lives,
no.
They have a totally different order of magnitude of average debt than current graduates do. So this is certainly something that I have not only felt, but I continue to watch escalate among my colleagues and really determine a lot about how their lives are and the level of stress that they carry.
So what do you think about this current system? You know, is it okay? I mean, is the cost too high to become a doctor? You know, what do you think about it?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an economic expert. I won't claim any expertise beyond my own expertise as a physician. But I think that we have to address the system as if it's broken. Another pediatric emergency medicine physician that runs a blog for academic pediatric emergency medicine physicians recently posted something where he calculated out his costs of training just in our subspecialty, and it was well over $1 million if you look at
wow.
deferred income and the cost of licensing, examinations, maintaining certifications. It
yep.
is overwhelming. And I even trained in a system that's very different from a lot of other house staff. Many people don't realize that pediatric residency programs that are run through freestanding children's hospitals are not funded through the same mechanisms as other residency programs are, and require annual reauthorization through Congress to keep going. So certainly I felt as a trainee during a period in which there were government shutdowns, how tenuous our funding system really is to support training, as well as feeling the burden and stress of young physicians when we come out of it with an average of nearly $200,000 in debt.
So what do you think the options are? You know, if this is the problem, what are some potential solutions?
Man, that is a question that is way over my pay grade. Yeah, I do think that there have been some phenomenal expert opinion pieces published in the New England Journal of Medicine last fall that looked at the pros and cons of the current payment structures to support house staff training. And there's certainly been a lot of discussion as well about the ballooning medical education debt. I think that one sort of bright star on the horizon is student loan forgiveness programs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what sort of we had in common with coming across this topic of public service loan forgiveness. Public service loan forgiveness will not kick in at the earliest until 2017. So none of us
close.
Really know
it's
what it's
getting
I know,
close.
we're getting there, but we still, you know, none of us know exactly what it's going to look like or what's going to happen when the first round of debt forgiveness comes around and the, you know, the amount of money that it presents to the government is really processed. But I do think that is a program that every training physician should be aware of, and very few, shockingly few, actually are aware of it.
I've actually crunched the numbers on this, which is kind of interesting, mm-hmm. in terms of what the cost is to the government. When you have interest rates at almost 7% on student debt, you know, on 200 grand, which is at least the average for most folks, if not more, you know, that's $14,000 a year in mm-hmm. interest. And so even if you're paying over $1,000 a month, you are barely, you're actually negative in that particular mm-hmm. case towards it. So the interest accrues. And so even if someone applied in residency and goes into practice and maybe they're getting paid $180,000, $190,000, $200,000 a year, my calculation was that it was actually a break-even proposition to the government over 10 years because of that high cost of interest. So it's kind of interesting to see what this is going to look like. But I think at the end of the day, it shouldn't be a big deal because of how much docs end up paying once they're in practice. But
yeah, what a great point. And I do have, from the perspective of the physicians on the Call Me Doctor site, I have a worksheet that's available that was specifically set up to show young physicians what the impact of moonlighting and generating income through moonlighting would be on debt forgiveness, but can also be used just to look at how your interest accrues on your specific total value of loans over the cost of your training and into your young faculty years, and give you a sense of what debt forgiveness would look like for any individual physician.
And some of the best advice I've heard, I'll share in a second on student debt, but I wonder, what's your perspective? What's the best advice regarding these programs that you've heard for student debt?
You know, I think I was really fortunate to graduate from a medical school that valued financial planning. I don't think I appreciated that until I began residency and realized that most of my co-residents had no idea how much medical education debt they owed, nor what to do about it. I was really astonished, and I'm so grateful. I'll give a shout-out to my alma mater, University of Chicago, Pritzker School of Medicine, that before we graduated, they had, I remember, you know, we had speakers from the AAMC come and talk about managing our student loans. We had a planner in-house that sat down and reviewed all of our financial loans with each of us, talked about different options, made sure that we understood what options we had, because it was a time when the landscape of forbearance and deferment were all changing. And so I remember making at the end of my fourth year of medical school a spreadsheet and looking at it with the advisor in our admissions office and coming up with a plan for how I was going to consolidate my loans over time to keep the lowest possible interest rate but yet still qualify for public service loan forgiveness and income-based repayment programs, and also how I was going to pay off my private loans within the first couple of years of residency. And I have stuck to that spreadsheet now 6 years later, and I feel like I am in a dramatically different place financially than I ever would have been if I didn't have access to those resources as a medical student.
Wow, if only everyone could have those kind of resources, right?
Yeah, it's been heartbreaking to me, honestly, to attend particularly women in medicine financial events and realize how little physicians have been educated about their loans and how much fear and avoidance and emotional stress and drain there is around them. Many people don't know how much money they owe. And until you know what you owe and sit with that number, you really can't even begin to make an educated plan about how to ideally have that debt forgiven or pay it all off.
And I was sitting with a couple late last year and early this year, and they two physician household, and female transitioned into practice this last year, and her husband going to primary care, finishing his residency a year from now. And between the two of them, you know, $550,000 in student debt.
Oh, my gosh.
And what we found as we crunched some numbers, and so this is quick piece of advice. This is the best piece of advice I've recommended and had read about, was if you are married, particularly for a two-physician household, and you are looking to get your debt forgiven in PSLF, look to do married filing separately because your payments are extremely low.
Yeah, so you can play absolutely.
Play with the calculators. And I encourage people, in addition to that, if you're going down that route, look to do another debt forgiveness program on top of that. One of the local ones, or through, particularly if you're in primary care, you know, there's urban programs and rural programs and all those different kinds of things. Do the two combined together if you can. So anyhow, a couple of my thoughts.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, the best piece of financial advice I ever got, period, was not specific to student loans or around medical education debt. It was when I graduated college. You know, I don't know what most people get as college graduation gifts, but what I got from my father was a single sheet of paper in an envelope, and it had typed across it a couple lines. It said, "I'm proud of you. Pay yourself first." And I think that was the single best advice that I've ever gotten, because it normalized thinking about financial planning. It took it for granted that it was something really important that I needed to be doing, even before I had much of an income. And pay yourself first is consistently the best advice I think anyone can get.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk more about the ladies. I know you are really passionate about women as physicians, being one yourself, and wanting to help ladies get in. I was actually reading an article last night and preparing for our interview, and it said World War II gave women for the very first time, the chance to work as docs, because there were a lot of men that were injured. Everyone was overseas. And so some medical institutions were open to keep them on staff, and others got rid of them. As a matter of fact, they had posted job offering signs after World War II saying doctors wanted, no women need apply. Well, we fast forward here many years later, and thank goodness times are changing. More medical schools began granting women admission. And from what I understand today, the ladies account for 23% of physicians in the United States, which doesn't sound like much. It's pretty nuts if you ask me. But now 43% of medical school graduates are female. So talk to us about how you see this gender gap changing.
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the really difficult truth that we have to face in particularly academic medicine is that the gender gap is not changing very fast. We, you know, just like you mentioned, medical school graduates now are about half women. Women really have begun to dominate a lot of different forms of higher education, and medicine is no different. But yet we only represent about 15% of leadership positions in academic medicine. 15%. There is still a tremendous gap in many institutions in pay, and pay at academic institutions, although this is not true across the board, is often opaque, where individual faculty members don't know what other faculty members make, which makes it harder to know if there's pay parity across gender. We know by looking at the numbers that women physicians are well represented at the entry-level faculty rank, assistant professorship, but that their numbers dwindle quickly when we hit associate professorship and then full professor onto deans. There was a recent article. I was just trying to think. You know, I can't recall off the top of my head the journal, but I will email it to you separately, and maybe you can append it to the podcast site.
Yeah, that'd be great.
An article that just came out recently that was based on a survey of, I believe that they were all associate or full professors at high-level academic institutions all over the country. And it specifically asked them how they felt like we were doing in different measures of gender inequality. And the news was pretty discouraging. It was, you know, that there was a lot of variability, that there's not much accountability at higher levels for institutions where women don't have equal or parity pay or equal likelihood of promotion, and that there was still a lot of silence and a lot of fear around this topic. So something that's important to me is kind of breaking that sisterhood of silence, acknowledging that this happens and that it exists, that there is still gender inequality in academic medicine, and finding really important strategies for how we can support each other and get past sort of the glass ceiling around promotion.
Well, in one of your recent posts on the blog that I read, you talked about how one of your female physician friends, she was just crushed, just absolutely crushed, when a mentor that they admired said some incredibly hurtful things. What happened?
Yeah, and I'll call her Rena. I change all the names on my blog post, but they're all true stories. And Rena's a personal friend of mine, also a very successful female physician, and had a mentor that was not only an important person in her department, but also someone that she considered a family friend. She and her husband are both physicians. They've known this individual most of their lives, having grown up locally. And one day when Rena was a little bit tired from taking care of a sick child at home overnight, this particular mentor, an older male, told her that she should be staying home with her children.
Wow.
And that, you know, his wife never would have considered working when their children were young. And this certainly was not feedback or comment that he had ever made to Rena's husband, nor would he make it to him. You know, it was clearly a gendered statement. And this was heartbreaking to Rena. She was absolutely devastated because this is someone who she really trusted with her career. It was not only her mentor, but it's a person in charge of her career development in her department.
Ouch.
And so it was, it's been very difficult for her on how to process that relationship and how to move forward. And I think that this is true for a lot of women, although it may not be that blatant that we have, you know, I think that sort of gendered statements are more subtle. We do know that they occur. We know that if you study the language used in letters of recommendation for men versus women physicians and trainees, that the language use is different and gendered. We know that women are less likely to get promoted. So we know it exists. It's just, I think, a little bit more subtle usually than what happens than what happened with Rena. And part of what I want women to hear a message is that there are relationships that we're going to encounter in our careers that are not productive. Many of them are going to be. And it's tough for anyone who spent, you know, for some of us, gosh, 30 years in the educational system where grades matter, evaluations matter,
Yes. You
know, getting people to like you matters. It's really, really difficult for us to let go of seeking approval. And just recognizing and acknowledging that there are some people's approval that we don't need, I think, is an important step.
Absolutely. And what about on the other side? For the person that gave that comment, you know, what would you say to them?
Oh, I mean,
outside of peeling the banana, and you know,
I would lose some politic language here, but I think even more so than what would I say is, you know, what should our institutions be saying? Like I said, you know, we know that there's a lot of variability in how much gender equality is addressed at various institutions. Some do a great job, some do a very poor job. And even within particular academic institutions, it varies tremendously from department to department. And I think that there needs to be a commitment at the highest levels of academic institutions to supporting gender equality, acknowledging that inequity exists, and creating a safe space for women like Rena to come forward when there are statements like that made. Because no matter what I would say to that individual, you know, what matters is what is the impact on their behavior and their career. And the simple truth is that there is no impact. There's no one hears about it beyond Rena and her friends.
It's so interesting. This is a problem, I think, that's pervasive in my industry, too. I'd like to bring it full circle and talk again about your blog. And we talked a little bit about burnout. There's a lot of docs that think that they can't make it anymore doing what they're doing, and they may be thinking of a second career. As a matter of fact, one of the best tax deductions that I talk about in my book is being a business owner, and I think it's really cool that you're working towards creating that extra stream of income. Well, here you are. You have this blog. You're doing it. Where do you envision this blog going another year or two or three from now?
What a great question. In disclosure to all listeners, you know, I read your book, The Financial Freedom Formula for Physicians, and I'm really looking forward to coming out. I'm going to feature it on my site because I think it has some fantastic advice for young doctors in a way that's really accessible. And I agree with you. I think that one of the sort of realizations that I've come around to is that when I look around not just my specialty, but academic medicine in general, that there are a few people with great career longevity, but there are many people who don't have that. And there's a whole variety of reasons why people walk away from academic medicine or from clinical practice in general, but I think that planning, making that plan for our exit strategy is an important step. That's a piece of advice that I've heard when I've interviewed other academic physicians at different points in their careers to find out what lessons they've learned and what they would recommend. Many of them tell me, I wish I had gone in thinking about how I would end my career. And so this blog is just one of many different things that I'm exploring and trying to see whether there are avenues for me beyond clinical medicine in the future when I get to the point where I'm just able to practice, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. I have no idea what the blog is going to look like, you know, in a year from now or 5 years from now. I certainly have ideas on how I can share more concrete information with my readers, as well as specific courses and how to help them get their financial lives in order and reduce the stress and help them feel like they're more balanced as they're going through their young faculty years.
Awesome, awesome. So what kind of topics, you know, are most on your heart that we can expect to see over the next couple months?
Yeah, you know, I'm really focused on three pillars that I think can help achieve better balance by maximizing our greatest asset, our earning potential as young physicians. Those three pillars are financial planning, maximizing productivity, and investing in our career development. And so I'm committed to bringing forward the best information that I have on those three topics, culled from a variety of different experts and sources, and I try to sort of digest them and then present them in a way that I think is more accessible to female physicians than many of the sort of frankly male-dominated financial advice sites and productivity sites. Because for most women, the goal is not about numbers. It's not about our bank accounts. It's not about the hours in the day. It's about having success on our own terms and feeling like we are able to balance our professional lives with our private lives.
Yeah, no, I totally see that. It's a tough balance, and I think guys do tend to get too tied to the numbers and don't see the forest beyond the tree when it comes to that stuff, so. I think it'll be great for the fellas to read as well as the ladies.
Yeah, and I respond to every single email that I get, and I love hearing from readers, and many of them are men. And although I don't always write with them as my specific readership in mind, I think that it's the same information that is just as relevant to men versus women. It's just presented in a way that I'm trying to design to be more accessible to women physicians, but equally applicable to men.
Absolutely. Well, you take the story that you told, right? I mean, there's lessons for that from mm-hmm. the male doctor and stuff that we all need to keep in mind and keep one another accountable for.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Tate. I'll look forward to reading your next post on your blog. Do you have any closing thoughts you want to share with everybody?
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you today. Like I said, I read every email that I get, and I look forward to hearing from readers. So if anyone would like more information or would like to drop me a line, you can find me on my website, callmedoctor.us, or you can reach me by email at thedoctorisin@callmedoctor.us.
All right, everybody, that's .us, so it's not .com, .us, so make sure to get that in there right. Well, thanks again for joining us, Dr. Tate. We'll look forward to chatting again. If you are a physician wanting to tell your story, grappling with these tough issues or other ones, and want to get on the soapbox for a few minutes, I'd love to share it too in the next Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Make sure to contact me at dave@daviddeniston.com or on my website, daviddeniston.com/physicians. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Deniston. Thanks so much for joining us, and make sure to subscribe and check in again soon. Have a good one.